This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beersmith episode number 51. Got a great show for you today. Drew Beecham's going to be on talking about Smash Brewing, which is a simplified brewing method. Don't have any big announcements today, but I'll just remind you, Beersmith 2.1 obviously is out, and our Beersmith Lite mobile app is out. Working really hard on the full version of the mobile app to come out shortly. And now, without further ado, let's jump right into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Drew Beecham. He's the author of the Everything Homebrewing book and author of a soon-to-be-released book, Homebrewer's Journal. He's also the former president of the Maltose Falcons. Drew, it's great to have you on the show.
It's good to be here, Brad.
So we're going to talk a little about Smash Brewing today. Can you start by talking about what Smash is? Because many people probably aren't familiar with that term.
Yeah, Smash is one of those terms that it kind of got invented, I think, about 5, 6, 7 years ago, mostly online from the guys at Homebrew Tech Talk, or sorry, homebrewtalk.com. And what it really means is single malt and, little a, single hop, big SH, big SM. And the whole idea was, you know, we have all these ingredients. We have, you know, kind of like you can walk into, you know, walk into your local homebrew shop and it's just a giant candy store and it's very confusing. And, oh my God, they released a new variety of hop. And, you know, how do we figure out what these things are good for? And so Smash kind of, as a modern homebrewer concept, evolved as this way of really, hey, let's test out our ingredients. And it's kind of grown since then. A lot of people, like, the original idea was really around the idea of, hey, we're going to test out all these different hops because I really want to know what Centennial tastes like. You know, what is this new hop Citra do?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of evolved a little bit since then.
So how'd you get started in Smash Brewing?
See that previous paragraph. It was all really about trying to figure out what my ingredients were doing. All right.
I gave a talk on it at the AHA conference last year. And in fact, I sat in and it was a great talk.
Well, thank you. I mean, but it's true. We have all these things nowadays. I mean, you read the old horror stories, you read like Charlie's first versions of the homebrewing book that he was doing, even looking at like Dave Miller and all these, and like you read, and like one of the big warnings that they gave you in there was, make sure your homebrewing store has fresh ingredients. If they keep the hops on the shelves, that's no good.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, as a guy who started homebrewing I did my very first batch of beer and my only first batch of beer back in like 1995, and then kind of went, I'll go do something else. When I came back to it in 99, the situation had changed so much. I have never had to worry about buying stale hops. I've never had to worry about, you know, oh, I only have, you know, 7 grains to choose from. And this was a big common problem.
It was a big problem. Yeah, I actually started brewing in 87. Yeah, and so I can tell you at that time, the hops were on the shelf.
Yeah, little brown sandwich bags
and, kind of turned, you know, over there, and stapled. There wasn't very many grains to choose from. In fact, very few people brewed all grain. A lot of people were just getting into extract at that time.
Yeah.
Things have changed dramatically.
And totally. And I think this is actually part of the reason why Smash has become such a popular concept recently is, I hate to put it in kind of these sort of derogatory terms, but it's the retro simplicity idea. Mm-hmm. We kind of see this with a lot of things, like I'm going to do everything handmade. I'm going to, like, you know, go back to pomade. It's just there's a sort of a longing, and it's always existed for simpler times. Yeah, kind of encapsulated by that whole good old days.
Yeah, organic brewing, maybe another offshoot like that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's actually, that's kind of a different take on it. Yeah,
we obviously
I want to go back to the days before chemicals got heavily involved. But so from the idea of retro brewing for homebrewers, though, is really the idea of, like, we have all this stuff. Is all of this really necessary? And if you look back in the old days of brewing, you know, if you look like at the time that IPA was invented, if you look at the time that, you know, like a lot of the things that we know, they didn't really have this giant selection of malts. You know, they had like three or four different pale malts or base malts, and then they had a couple of other darker color malts. And everything that they made beer-wise was out of that. As we've gone on now, suddenly we've gotten more and more things, and it just gets more and more confusing. So what I've always found is that, you know, you get what I call new brewer syndrome, which is also the kid in the candy store syndrome, where you just start walking through the homebrew store and go, I want to make a stout, so I'm going to put a little this in there, a little this in there, and a little this, and this, and this, and this, and this. And the next thing you know, you got like 12 different malts in your beer.
I mean, you made the point at the conference that that's how a lot of people really get started when they design their first recipe, right? It's everything but the kitchen sink. I know that was the case for me.
No, it totally is. It was for me. And I mean, I'm still not immune to it. You know, like I still find myself sometimes in the home brewing store going, I've never used that. I think I'll use that now. And then I come home, and fortunately, one of the things I do is I weigh everything out separately and I keep it in little baggies. Mm-hmm. So like, I don't do the whole, like everything in one bag. Because usually by the time I turn around, I get to brewing, I come to my senses and go, you're being dumb. Don't do that. But yeah, so Smash really did start out, for me at least, as kind of an extension of the whole, you know, kind of scientist motif of, I want to know, you know, the effect. You know, you also see it in chefing, you know, like, you know, the classic test for a cook is, make me a simple omelet, right?
Yeah.
And it's all about, like, what can you do with a very simple batch of ingredients and make something that expresses, you know, how you feel and how you are as a cook. And so as a brewer, it's the same thing. But now we just kind of put a big scientific sheen on it. Like, I must know my ingredients now. Hmm.
So another really important point I think you made is that a lot of commercial brewers really do use a small number of ingredients, which totally. Is kind of interesting. I was wondering if you could just talk to that for a minute, because I thought that was a great
You look at the commercial brewery. The one thing that every commercial brewery that I know of out there does not have in plethora is space. Now, I mean, you walk into like your average little microbrewery that's just started, you know, not too long ago, and they're just kind of jamming things into every space and every corner that they possibly can.
50-pound bags all over the place.
Because, you know, it's like, well, yes, we needed to install a new fermenter. We needed to get another 200 kegs, and we don't have the room for it. Well, I guess the malt's going over there. And so what that means is that you really don't have room to go and store, like, I've got a half a sack of this and a third of a sack of this and three quarters of a sack of this. You know, it's like, you might be able to make room for it, but it's going to be a nightmare for the next time that you need to go find it. So,
well, not only that, you got to order it too, right? They order it in big quantities. They don't order.
Yeah, totally.
Half a bag.
Yeah. I mean, I do have to laugh. Like I've seen some of my local breweries, actually go to like their nearby homebrew shop and go, hey, by the way, can I buy a sack of this off of you? Or can I buy like a pound of this variety of hops? Which is cute, but it's not usually the way that they work. Yeah, I mean, it's totally right. It's like, hey, we have to order, you know, 1,000 pounds of grain. So, you know, throwing an extra sack in here and there is just kind of this weird impractical thing that you're going to do. And so, yeah, most breweries, I mean, you can really think of your standard microbrewery as being its own standalone homebrew shop. Yeah, they've got in a certain number of parts that they can fit into the space they have, which, as we said earlier, is not much. And that's what they've got to work with. You know, they can't go, I'm going to do a little of this, a little of that, and a little of this. So that's kind of where, when you look at these homebrew recipes or these homebrew versions of pro recipes, you know, things like Pliny the Elder or, you know, like anything that you see in Zymergy from, hey, you know, Surly gave us their recipes this month. You know, you look at them and they're very simple in terms of like what they're actually using.
Yeah.
And it's entirely because no brewer wants to go move 20, 50 pound sacks in order to get to the half sack of something that they're going to use for this batch of beer, if they even have the room for it.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I've noticed as we've gone through, you know, I've been doing interviews, obviously, I think we're at episode 51 now, but interviews with quite a few people that have written books on, you know, individual styles of, you know, people that have gone to Belgium to study the Belgian style or gone to England to study IPAs. And one of the things that comes out every time is when they actually start talking about what grains they use, it's usually one, two, three, maybe tops.
Yeah.
And same thing with the hops, usually one variety of hops.
Oh, yeah. Well, my classic example, the one I love to kind of really drive home this point, is the number one rated beer in the world, according to some people, is Westwater and 12, right? Big, huge, complex beer, you know, like 11, 12% alcohol, rich and redolent, full of, you know, plums and spices and everything else. And, you know, really just a perfect night in a glass.
Mm-hmm.
And at least if the rumors are to be believed, because, well, they're monks and vow of silence and all that sort of fun stuff, Westwater and 12 is really nothing more than Pilsner malt and dark candy syrup and like a hop addition or two. And then it's the West Mall yeast. And that's it.
Yeah, we were talking about Belgians a few episodes back, and a lot of them don't even use candy syrup.
Yeah, no, I mean...
Or candy sugar, they just use sugar. Because they're really just looking to add a little bit of alcohol and without adding a lot of body.
And you know, and that's totally true with like any of the pale Belgian beers, like when you're talking like a triple.
Yeah.
To my mind, unless you've got a really sensitive palate that can taste the effects of the stress that you're causing when you force yeast to produce invertase.
Mm-hmm.
Plain old table sugar is absolutely fine.
Yeah.
And really you can get around those harsh flavors of any sort of invertase stress by giving your beer a little more yeast.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Yeah, and so that's the reason why I always kind of laugh when I see people like really going through big, long machinations of, I'm going to get beet sugar, I'm going to get, you know, this, and I'm going to do that. It's like going, you know, you really don't have to worry about that, right?
Yeah, sugar. Well, let's go back to Smash, though, for a minute. What kind of beer styles lend themselves to Smash?
Oh, man, it's almost ridiculous the amount of things that fit into Smash. Again, keep in mind, you know, single malt, single hop. You look at most of the classic old school beer recipes or beer styles, they're all smashy beers. Because again, you know, back in the day, brewers didn't really have a lot of different ingredients. So, I mean, Bohemian Pilsner to me is the perfect example of something that's smash oriented, right? You think of the classic Pilsner.
Mm-hmm.
It is a Pilsner malt that's triple decocted, if you're going to really go for it, and Zotz hops. That's mm-hmm. it. And depending upon how you treat your yeast, how you do your decoction, how you conduct your boil, you know, what sort of, you know, the form of your hops and whatnot, you can get a ton of different flavors out of this very, very simple little package. And then once you roll up away from Bohemian Pilsner, you've got German Pilsner, Vienna Lager, Munich Dunkel, virtually every wild ale that you can think of out there, you know, is really just a smashy beer because the hops don't matter. And really, usually it's, if it's anything more than Pilsner or pale malt, it's maybe a little bit of wheat, you know. IPA, the original IPAs were all single malt.
I was shocked to find that out.
Yeah,
we had awesome? Mitch Steele come on, I think it was two episodes ago, and talk about that.
Yeah, well, and that was the thing I loved at the Seattle conference. I gave my talk all about this, you know, weird smashy, you know, like smashy and beyond. And then Mitch also had his IPA talk. And I, you know, walked in and I sat down at his talk because I was like, hey, you know, I really want to hear about it. And he started talking about how the original IPAs were done and the fact that they were this, you know, Burton white malt. And that was it. And I said, one, that validates exactly what I'm talking about. And then two, he said, well, you know, it's really hard to get your hands on as a home brewer. And so what a lot of the British homebrewers I talk to will do is mix, you know, Maris Otter and some pale malt, you know, like they'll do these two different malts together. And I'm like going, oh my God, that's exactly what I do for every IPA and pale ale and that I've ever done. And so I just kind of walked away and, you know, feeling very chuffed. And then when I later saw Mitch, I said, thank you. You have made me feel much, much smarter. But yeah, I mean, there, if you think of any sort of classic, classic beer style, it's probably originally started off as smash. Another good example, before I totally forget it, is barley wine. Mm-hmm. I think all the original British barley wines, you know, these big hefty beers that we think, yeah, they weren't going full hog with, you know, 90 different caramel malts and everything else in with their pale malt. It was, hey, you know, we just put in, you know, many, many, many bushels of our pale malt and boiled the ever living bejesus out of it. And that's what a barley wine start does. So it's a perfect example of a beer that you can do as a smash style.
I know you're a big fan of Saison, or an expert in Saison, I should say.
Fan, expert, I will take anything that you say, because if you just put a Saison in front of me, I'll be happy.
Yeah. I know that's another popular style, though, that works well with smash.
Yeah, I've been amazed. Yeah, so obviously, I spend a lot of time trolling around online, watching for what people are talking about and seeing what I can, how I can help, and you know what sort of things I can talk about that'll be useful to people. And I have to admit, so when I started homebrewing, Saison was not this thing that people knew. And now, recently, going onto a lot of these beer forums, I see it's almost like every third or fourth thread is, "Hey, I'm going to make a Saison," and I'm like going, "Why? Well, I can help you there, I think."
Yeah, we had Nathan Smith last week actually talking about Saison in episode 50. So.
He lied. I don't care what he said. He lied.
He said you knew a lot about Saison.
Well, in that case, he actually.
Oh, okay. There you go. Drew, could you walk us through a typical smash, and you know, how do you sit down and select the hops and the malt to use for, you know, pick a style, for example? Maybe talk about Saison, whatever you like.
Okay, yeah, I think Saison's a perfect place. So one of the reasons why you can really do Saison as a smash is because so much of the characteristic of what we think of as a Saison comes from the yeast. So, you know, that kind of that dry earthiness, the spiciness, everything else comes from the yeast if you're treating the yeast right. Where I've actually really loved to play around with the smash concept in Saisons is in doing what so far has been loosely termed as American Saison. Mm-hmm. Which is really a Saison style beer with American hops. And where things have gotten really interesting recently is with all these brand new hops that are coming on the market. You know, things like the Citra, Galaxy, these things that instead of being pine cone, citrus, spice, are now things like mango, watermelon, grape.
Yeah.
Because wow, it's just totally different now. Mm-hmm. So for me, I have something that I kind of think of as my Zen Saison, and it's not completely smash. It's close, because it's okay. For about a 5.5 gallon batch, it's 11, 12 pounds of Pilsner malt.
Mm-hmm.
And then about a pound or so of flaked oats, because I like the oats to have just that little kind of buffering.
And then what do you go with for hops?
For hops, that I typically take somewhere in about the high 20s, low 40s range of IBUs.
Right. And but which variety?
Well, I mean, if you want just plain Jane, the only thing you want to suggest, or the only thing that you, the main thing you want to get out of the beer is the yeast character.
Mm-hmm.
Really go for something neutral. Anybody who's read my recipes knows I am a big dumb fan of Magnum, because Magnum, to my mind, is just super, super easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's clean. It's neutral. It doesn't influence the beer in any sort of way. And really, you can make a wonderful yeast characteristic type Saison with Pilsner malt, some oats, Magnum, and then the yeast. And I've done the experiment a couple times now where I've done, you know, several different varieties of Saison yeast, several different temperature treatments, force heating, natural rise, keeping it cold, etc., just to see exactly what will happen. And that is an absolutely perfect way to play with that. Now, if you want to go on the American angle with it, then you can really find some of these new hops and play around with them and see what sort of characteristics that you get out of them. Citra, by far and away so far, has been my favorite in terms of this, because you just get these wonderful tropical fruit characters that play in very nicely with the yeast. I tend to think that the more traditional American hops, Centennial, Cascade, Columbus, you know, anything that has that kind of very strong pine characteristic to it, along with the citrus, don't work as well up against the phenols and the esters that you get from the yeast. But that is something that I've come to the conclusion of after doing many of these sort of very, very simple beers, you know, and try to find out what exactly appeals to my taste.
So, Drew, obviously some malts are more flavorful than others. Which ones do you prefer for smash brewing?
I think the right way to go for most of these beers is really look for, you know, the things that have a sort of a darker color, kind of a more heady aroma. This goes right back to what I've always counseled people whenever you're looking at malts, which is really get your hands into the malts, take a couple of kernels and chew on them. You know, because that way you can actually really find out what they're going to taste like. You know, kind of take a couple kernels, crush them up in your mouth, hold it there for a little bit. Let the amylase that's in your saliva go ahead and start converting the starch into sugar. And then you'll get a better idea of what these things are going to taste like. For me, I think, bar none, the no-brainer for most, you know, single malt type beers is going to be Maris Otter.
Got a lot of flavor, right?
Oh yeah, I mean it's. I could eat a bowl of Maris Otter. So to me, like, if you're going to do anything near a British style, a British influence style, British tradition, or screw it, I want to be British somehow, Maris Otter is a great way to start. Golden Promise is also right in that same category. And it's really what I find is it's these slightly more highly kilned malts out there that seem to do much better. If you're doing something like the Bohemian Pilsner that we talked about before, mm-hmm. You also kind of find one of these very rich Pilsner malts, right? You get a lot of the kind of the Pilsner malts that are very, very grassy. And that's not a bad characteristic. But if it's too grassy, when you're particularly trying to do something that's simple, it's not going to taste right. You know, you're going to taste like you're in the middle of a hay bale, as opposed to, you know, kind of a nice, cool, refreshing beer.
Yeah.
So really, I mean, this is one of those places where I think the local homebrew shop can rock, because then you can sit there and go, I will taste this, and yes, I think this will be right. Like, for instance, a perfect example, there's a highly kilned malt out there that I do not like at all. From Gambrinus. It's their ESB malt. I have some of my friends who are a big fan of this malt. Like, every time I've tasted it, the couple times I've brewed with it, it doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
But this is not something that I would have discovered if I hadn't actually tried to play with it. And for the folks out there at the Gambrinus Malting Company who may go, hey, why is he saying bad things about our malt? I'm saying it doesn't work for me.
There's other people that probably do just fine with it, right?
Totally. I have a friend of mine who makes a wonderful bitter that uses that malt. I don't know how he does it, and I can't do it. But I'm just going to assert that that's a matter of the soul and not something up for scientific scrutiny.
Okay, what about hops? You mentioned Magnum, obviously, but there's other hops I'm sure that work well with this particular style.
Yeah, the main thing that you want to go, and this is going to be sort of paradoxical, you either want a hop that's fairly neutral, like Magnum. Mm-hmm. Warrior is another classic example from the American side of the fence. It's kind of more in the American tradition. Both of them will give you characters if you're using them in a sort of a complete hop bill to try and do aroma and flavor, but they're not going to be very assertive. So that's one thing. Go very neutral. The other way is go with something very big character. Talked about Citra already. Talked about some of these other new hops that are out there. Motuka, the other New Zealand hops, Sauvignon Nelson, which is the one that nobody can ever get their hands on anymore.
Right.
Simcoe is great for this. Obviously, Bell's for years has been doing a fantastic IPA with nothing but Centennial. And although I wouldn't suggest it, somebody out there has made a beer supposedly with nothing but Chinook hops and built a giant brewing company off of it.
No kidding.
And so really it's coming down to playing with. I think there's a lot of kind of the middle ground hops. I really would avoid anything that's in the low alpha acids, anything that's like, you know, I know we talked about Zots for Bohemian Pilsner earlier, but you know, like when you get those Zots hops that are like 2.4% alpha acid, when you get like Fuggles that come in at 4.5, if you're trying to get any sort of hop load, like any sort of IBU load, you really want to avoid those hops as a total smash concept.
You end up boiling them for a long time, right?
Yeah, you end up boiling them for a long time, which means that you get, and also you have to use a lot, which means that you end up with a lot of the kind of the chlorophyll characters. Yeah, you know, kind of those green vegetal.
Grassy, yeah.
And you really don't want those. And I think you can avoid those by bending the smash rules just a little bit. And so what I'll advocate is that if you want to go for a distinctive aroma and flavor characteristic out of a low alpha acid hop, like Fuggles or Zots, I have absolutely no problems with somebody substituting a very neutral bittering hop, getting their bitterness that way, and then going forward with these character hops. To that point, like think of like Pliny the Elder, right? Everybody's favorite double IPA. That beer uses hop extract for its bitterness. You know, they're not really extracting hop flavor and hop aroma characteristics out of it. And yet the beer has fantastic characteristics because they've structured the later parts of the beer that way.
Now, what about high alpha hops? I know a lot of people have been experimenting with high alpha hops, and it turns out that a lot of these high alpha hops don't really have necessarily bad aroma or bad flavor to them. It's just people were scared of them, I think, for quite a while.
Well, and rightfully so, because a lot of the earlier high alpha acid hops, things, Chinook is one of those examples. There's another old school hop called Eroica. And these first real attempts at making high alpha acid hops, yeah, sure, you got a lot of alpha acid, but they also had really, really horrible characteristics in almost any other use. So you would try and make a beer with nothing but Eroica, and you couldn't get it anywhere near the aroma because, you know, suddenly you're tasting blackberries and cat pee. There was also a version of Cluster called Super Cluster that did the same thing. And what I found is that in modern times, with all these kind of low cohumulone hops that they're using nowadays, you see that term low cohumulone, low coho, those hops where they're in their high alpha acids do fantastic, pretty much in any part of the stream. A few years back, there was a hop that kind of first hit the market called Summit. It was a dwarf high alpha acid hop, still around. And it was one of those ones, though, that kind of cautioned you on some of these uses, because if you got the right batch, the right year, and the right storage characteristics out of the hop, you would get these really wonderfully intense tangerine IPAs out of it. If you got one that they left the hops on the bind too long, they were aged, they aged the wrong way, or they were stored too long, what you got was basically green garlic and green onion.
Oh, wonderful.
So it's kind of hard to give like an absolute yes, you can do this list, because we see the same characteristic with Simcoe, which gets cat pee or onion. Citra also gets, there's kind of a rotten character that comes in with Citra in some of the cases I've seen. But really, it's like, if you're going to go high alpha, look for a low coho hop and kind of feel free to lard it everywhere.
Right.
I've always recommended to people, if you want an IPA that really tastes like an IPA and you've got a bunch of loco hops, the right thing to do is when you're in the boil stage, when you're doing that bittering addition at 60 minutes, add a very tiny amount of Chinook, like quarter ounce for a 5.5 gallon batch. And what that will do is that will give you that extra little kind of harsh, raspy edge that you expect out of an IPA.
Let's talk about extending the smash concept just a bit. Perhaps, you know, if we go to two malts or two hops, now you can, turns out you can brew almost any style, right?
Yeah, you can get pretty close to just about anything that you'd ever want to do. To me, I think the classic sort of two malt beer is almost anything from Scotland, right? Mm-hmm. And deep characteristics, but particularly Track Warehouse. Hmm. Right? Track Warehouse is the legendary wee heavy of Scotland.
Right.
In so many ways, it's kind of held up as the exemplar of the style. It's produced in very small quantities, and you really kind of have to look around to find it. And I'm always very happy when I can, because it's a really wonderful, rich beer. Mm-hmm. And it's made from, take your pick, Maris Otter or Golden Promise, and then a small, tiny skosh of roasted barley. And then it's boiled for like 3 hours.
Wow. And why did they do that?
Well, because when the current laird of the manor got his title and took over the manor house, he found the brewery, like this discontinued brewery on the estate, and found the brewer's logs. And hey, you know, like, this is what happened, and old school recipes. And it's not really much more than about 100 years ago before people stopped abandoning the idea of, oh, we have to boil this beer for, 300 minutes. And so, kind of the recipe is kind of in that tradition. To me, Track Warehouse is a perfect example of a beer that you can make with exactly two malts.
So have you got a couple other double malt examples? I mean, a lot of the darker beers, obviously, we get into now.
Yeah, I mean, even some simple, even just when you add in like a single extra malt to a lot of things, you can get a lot more complex. And we talked about the Saison.
Saison.
And, how that had oats or oat malt in it. Mm-hmm. I have a beer that I like to do. I love rye. I think rye can lend a lot of very interesting characteristics and things. And so I did a beer for my talk that was actually what I called the Mo Rye Mild. And the Mo was Maris Otter, and the rye was rye malt from Weyermann. Mm-hmm. And looking at my recipe notes over here for a beer that came in about 10:38 or so, it was 8 pounds of Maris Otter and a pound of rye malt.
Wow.
And, let that mash, let that steep, come out on the other side, and you get 5.5 gallons. And I did the whole thing there where rye malt won't add a lot of color, right? It's not a very dark malt. But I kind of like my mild to have a little bit more color than just like a straight up bitter, even when I'm doing an AK. And so I took the first gallon and a half of the runnings that I had, actually for the 5.5 gallons, I took the first half gallon of the runnings, and I boiled it down to really about a pint. And it was this wonderfully dark, sticky, sweet stuff. And once I got the rest of the beer going, added that syrup back in and allowed that to actually darken the beer up a little bit, give a little more caramel and everything else. And really, that's an old school technique for doing that sort of thing. When you hear about a lot of Scottish recipes, for instance, going back to that, they do the same thing. Scorch the first, X portion of your wort to produce dark caramelized sugars, and then use that to color and flavor your beer. So I think that's a perfect example of that.
Fantastic. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about Smash as a philosophy instead of a strict set of rules, for example?
Yeah, I think the main thing that Smash should teach you, or kind of what I also kind of term brewing on the ones, is the idea that simplicity often rules. Again, going back to the kitchen sink example, the candy store example, there we go. It's too easy to go nuts.
Right.
But the big thing that happens when you do that, when you have, 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 different malts and hops and everything else in these beers, is everything just becomes a giant mishmash. Right? Yeah, it all really kind of mixes together. Nothing's distinct. And it really becomes, in a lot of ways, what I consider to be the taste equivalent of brown. And so Smash, or the Ones thing as a philosophy, is really, it's really just, it's an expression of the classic engineering philosophy, which is, you know, KISS, keep it simple, stupid. And the theory or the practice goes that if you allow yourself to step back and avoid overloading what you're doing, you allow the ingredients themselves to express themselves. They show their true characteristics. They come through, and things are more focused. So when somebody's tasting the beer, you don't get hit with the biscuit tones of Maris Otter, the sweetness of the sweetness of a caramel 60, the plumminess of a caramel 120, the kind of burnt coffee of a roasted barley. All this stuff trying to fight and mix together on your tongue to make something as like a cohesive, you know, kind of a cohesive thing, right? If you think musically, when you go and you pick up your guitar, right? Yeah, you can sit there and just randomly place your fingers on the neck and go strum and produce something that's just god awful because you've decided I want to mix my finger here and this finger here and this finger here. But if you do everything right, yeah, you know, you produce this wonderful sounding chord, right? And so as sort of a philosophy and something to take away is that really most of the time we as brewers and we as, you know, people are going to be far more successful if we can keep things on the simpler side of the fence. So that's how I look at it. Some people have heard me talk about this before and taken away this idea that I say, if you're using more than two malts, you're wrong and you're doing something terrible and da-da-da-da-da. And that's totally not what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say with this is I want all of your choices to be considered and deliberate. And most of the time, I think you are your most considered and deliberate when you're doing things on the simpler side of the fence.
Yeah.
You have a greater chance of success. You have a greater chance of learning something from your ingredients. And really everybody else before you in the supply chain has done a hell of a job to get you something that has a unique and interesting characteristic. And so maybe you want to kind of consider playing with that instead of trying to, you know, turn everything into a movie symphony.
Well, that's a great way to sum it up. I really appreciate that. Since we got a few minutes here at the end, I thought maybe I'd just ask about the new book that you're working on.
Oh yeah. This is something kind of fun that came up at the last minute. The same folks who've published my other book, which is the Everything Homebrewing book, approached me earlier this year and said, hey, you know, we want to put together a brewer's notebook. We have a couple ideas. We've read through your book and, you know, we took away these concepts. Can you work with us to come up with something better? And so, yeah, the Homebrewer's Journal, which is going to come out in January of 2013, is a notebook that's designed for brewers to track everything about your brew day, from your initial conceptions of the recipe, what you were aiming for, which is actually kind of something that I think most brewing journals miss. You know, we all have this picture in our head of what the beer is going to be. So, you know, what are you trying to aim for? You know, what ingredients are you going to use? With, you know, what do you have on your hand? What do you need to buy? What'd you do with your fermentation? Like, all the stuff that, you know, we really think that we need to track. And the good thing is that, I mean, this is really designed for people who, you know, may not want to use a computer, you know, may not be that sort of person. And it's the physical notebook that you have a physical artifact of. And it goes all the way through for a single recipe to track, you know, everything about the fermentation and everything else to what you thought your tasting notes were, what your perceptions of it were, what judges thought of it and everything else, just so you have kind of a unified experience for a single beer in a single area. And, you know, it was kind of just a fun little project, and hopefully people find it useful.
So who's publishing that for you?
That's coming from Adams Media. It's going to be available, you know, pretty much in any of your major bookstores.
Amazon and so on.
Yeah, it's actually, they just listed it on Amazon about 2 weeks ago. And I saw it and I went,
there you go. So January 2013, right? Coming up real soon.
Yeah.
Looking forward to that. Well, Drew, is there anything else you'd like to add before we go?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing I would like to add about the whole Smash concept is, I think where it started with the idea of focusing on singular ingredients is a good place and something that's very easy to understand. I think as time has gone by and I've played with it more, I think one of the important things to kind of consider is that really the philosophy is not so much, you know, strict Smash as much as it is you're trying to find easy to work with similar flavor characteristics. So I had somebody email me earlier and they wanted to talk about Vinny's Plenty of the Elder recipe in relation to Smash stuff, which of course is the kind of thing that gives me, you know, kind of bell quaking doubts because who am I compared to Vinny? And you know, they were looking at the Plenty of the Elder recipe that Vinny's published in comparison to what I was talking about with Smash, and you know, they wanted me to help kind of reconcile some of those differences. And in looking at the recipe, the biggest thing that you notice about it, and the biggest thing that you talk about out of it, is that even though a recipe like Plenty of the Elder uses more than one malt, when you really look at it, all of the malts that it uses, and it's only three malts, are all kind of in a very similar flavor vein, right next to each other. You know, they're kind of some different characteristics, you know, a little bit of this, a little of that, but really nothing way out of bounds. It's not like you're mixing pale malt with, you know, Crystal 75 and da-da-da-da-da and this. And so, really, I think maybe one of the places that we need to kind of develop the Smash concept and take it is away from that strict adherence to the scientific measure of a list, you know, the scientific quantity of grains, to a more subjective idea about a sort of a singular flow of flavor, right? To try and really kind of develop that chord concept where we kind of keep things in a harmonious relationship with each other. Maybe that's a different way to think of the ingredients and kind of take that forward a little bit. So that's kind of where I'm going with it right now. So I think this will be interesting to see and you know, see if we can't develop, since brewers are very kind of rule oriented, you know, see if there isn't a way that we can develop some rules around this that will, you know, kind of help clarify it and help make people kind of, you know, get into that groove and flow. Because ultimately, I think that's where all these sort of simplicity mantras lead you, is into this idea of harmony.
Well, thank you, Drew. Really appreciate you being on the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And again, my guest today was Drew Beecham. He's the author of the Everything Homebrewing book and also author of the soon-to-be-released book, Homebrewer's Journal. Well, a big thank you to Drew Beecham for appearing on the show. I'd like to remind you to sign up for our newsletter at beersmith.com. Just click on the little newsletter button on the right side, and we'll send you an article on homebrewing every single week. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.